You're listening to the Today in Manufacturing podcast.
Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to the 11th episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me today are Jeff Branke and Anna Wells. We're the editors of Manufacturing.net and Industrial Equipment News, and we each have about 15 years covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we cover the five top stories in manufacturing and the implications they have on the industry moving forward. Before we get started, please make sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by giving us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you use. Finally, if you want to reach out to us, you can email us at Jeff, Anna, or David at IEN.com and just put email the podcast in the subject line. Jeff, how are you doing this week?
Awesome. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. Anna?
Great.
That's great. We're all swell. Top story this week. The auto industry's newest hurdle is a rubber shortage. GM, Ford, and other automakers around the world are increasing shutdowns as the industry deals with a global shortage of semiconductors. Now, the auto industry is facing another critical shortage, rubber. According to Bloomberg, rubber supplies are dwindling due to a snarled shipping lines, and China is stockpiling the material. Leaf disease has also ravaged rubber trees, and the pandemic led to a surge in demand of rubber gloves. Rubber trees take 7 years to mature, so rubber producers might not bounce back anytime soon, leaving the market deflated.
Well done.
Thank you.
It's not as good as catch up from last week, but well done.
I liked it.
Anna, your thoughts on the rubber shortage?
Yeah, so this came from a Bloomberg report, and they cited a lot of legitimate evidence that suggests this rubber shortage is already here. Mm-hmm. Yet the automakers are pretty much saying that they're monitoring it, but it hasn't impacted them yet. But as David mentioned, the cycle on rubber is a long one. It's not as simple as building plants to produce semiconductors, which seems to be how the U.S. auto industry is solving that problem. And Intel's obviously playing a big role there. But with this rubber issue, so China's been hoarding it, kind of, and despite the economy being rough in 2020, China still bought as much rubber in 2020 as they had the year prior, just for their national stockpile, despite not using as much. But the other part of this is that rubber prices have been so low for so long that the producers, which, you know, these are in places like Thailand and Vietnam, where rubber trees actually grow, they've had no incentive to continue to plant them, because the money just hasn't been there. So now that there's a shortage, it's truly going to be kind of this tug of war of a very finite supply, which may push the auto industry and tire makers, I guess, towards adding more synthetics. Though natural rubber, according to like Michelin, has very specific benefits, right? Mm-hmm. Including, you know, its ability to reduce heat generation in tires and offer mechanical resistance. So, you know, it's not just tires, too. The automotive industry uses rubber for things like anti-vibration components under the hood, according to Bloomberg, where they say synthetics aren't actually a great substitute. So it'll be interesting to see, like, what happens next. It's not, I don't think, easily solvable problem.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about their dwindling supply, it sounded like, they had spent this past year just pretty much using up everything that they had in storage or in their inventory.
Yeah.
Jeff, what do you think about the
Well, it's interesting.
Shortage?
Yeah. When you look at rubber overall, it's, you know, just doing a little bit of research, basically production levels have almost doubled in the last 20 years. So they are doing more, but like Anna alluded to, the prices have not increased in the same manner. So not a real big motivation to increase production or paying attention to other market factors that the pandemic has created. It's not surprising, however, when you look at this, that the two are so closely tied together. The global rubber industry, like 60% of their business is tires. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not just vehicles, automotive vehicles. That can be lawn tractors and things like that as well, but still a very close connection. And then about another 10 to 13%, depending on who you look at, is also automotive related for other components under the hood and in other places. So a very high reliance on the rubber industry in terms of their automotive customers. So to see the two tied so closely together is not surprising. Mm-hmm. The China connection, I think, is a huge one. China is the number five rubber manufacturer in the world. So if they're not only making that much, but then hoarding it and buying it from some of their geographically close partners, you can see why there's a lot of a supply chain issue. Obviously, China and the U.S. from a trade perspective, not best friends right now.
Right.
So you can see them leveraging that potentially in other areas for what they need to. We've talked a lot about China and the Huawei situation, as well as some of the other things going on with textile and textile companies and some of the cotton and other things that are coming out of China as well.
Well, some of the other shortages, you know, things that are becoming scarce. Bloomberg mentioned seating foam, metal, and plastic resin are also becoming scarce. So we did a story previously about how Ford was able to work around the semiconductor shortage in some capacity, making trucks without computers, which, you know, made them less fuel efficient. But it's hard for me to imagine cars going to market without tires or seats.
Yeah, you know, the first thing I actually kind of thought about, and we've talked about this, but like when you go to antique tractor pulls and they have the steel wheel tractors and stuff, obviously not at all feasible for what we need to do here, but sort of a flashback there. I mean, there were wheels before rubber, just not very reliable ones.
They also had metal spikes in them. Right. Like,
when you go to antique tractor pulls, like that's like some universal thing that everyone does.
That's what I do.
Yeah. You guys got plans?
Yeah,
this
weekend? Two out of three.
Oh, man.
I haven't been to a good tractor pull in a while. Things that shut down that you didn't realize you missed. We also had one reader that said, you know, is this an auto industry problem or is this more of a tire industry problem? To which another reader replied, yeah, cars kind of suck without tires.
True.
Our fourth most popular story this week, Segway is making a motorcycle. Segway, the mode of transportation that was only cool if you were on a field trip, never really took off as an alternative to scooters or bikes. However, Segway might not be culturally irrelevant yet, as the company unveiled a hydrogen-powered motorcycle, and it kind of looks cool. The company stopped making Segways in 2020, but it still produces scooters, mopeds, and ATVs, even go-karts. The motorcycle is called the Apex H2, and it was recently unveiled in China. And it can reach up to 90 miles per hour and has 80 horsepower from a hydrogen electric powertrain. The electricity comes from hydrogen that's stored in swappable, pressurized canisters. The expected price in China equals out to about $11,000 US, and it can go from 0 to 60 in 4 seconds. Anna, I saw this thing that looked really cool just because it reminded me of the Tron light cycle.
It's so cool looking.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed this story. It was so interesting because I learned a lot about a company that I thought was already dead.
Yeah.
Like, well, because, you know, we know that the Segway like went out of production in 2020, but apparently the company behind it, Segway Ninebot, and it was bought by Ninebot in 2016, I think. They've really been driving innovation in the world of scooters and things like delivery robots and ATVs. And now this hydrogen powered motorcycle. One thing that I thought, I don't know. In this case, I wonder how the brand recognition of Segway impacts this. Like, it's such a cool looking vehicle. Like, it's super slick and futuristic, but it's kind of a double-edged sword with the Segway name, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you.
Yeah, like, you can't disassociate that with the namesake device, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of unpopular and almost a punchline at one point. Like, it doesn't exactly carry, like, a cool factor. I mean, now Segway riders are, like, middle-aged tourists with fanny packs on. So I don't know, maybe that's what makes this product perfect for China and not suitable, at least currently, for an American market that not only doesn't suit hydrogen, but also might face some stiff competition from other bike manufacturers who are also exploring electric, but in a more conventional way. And, you know, competitors like Harley and Suzuki certainly have more cool points. But I don't know. I mean, that said, does the target demographic for this even remember the original Segway? Because that was like 20 years ago. So maybe not. Maybe we do. But, you know, I'm not 20 years old either. So,
yeah, maybe there's like a perfect crossroad there between like stained brand brought back with like an EV spin and, you know, your parents hated it. So then it's okay.
It's complex, yeah.
Yeah.
I think what we're seeing in that regard is just any kind of brand recognition is just so highly valued right now, just to stand out. When we look at non-gasoline-powered motorcycles right now, Harley probably has the biggest name out there with their electric version, the Livewire. Honda's got an electric bike, but a lot of the other non-gas powered, and this one's hydrogen, so it's not the same as an electric, obviously, but right. those other ones that are in that market, they're more boutique motorcycle manufacturers. The big guys are looking maybe at scooters and things like that. So I think the fact the Segway, just that it is recognizable in some way, even if somebody does have to Google Segway and where it comes from, they've heard it before. So I think that's really what they're going for, because a lot of these others that are sort of springing up, they don't have a brand recognition to them. You know, Zero, some of the others, mm-hmm. other than Harley Davidson and Honda and et cetera, they don't. So if you're going to be different, at least this brand has some recognition to it mm-hmm. that people can draw from and stand out. I think they did do a great thing with the look. It is a cool looking bike. Yeah. What's interesting is the horsepower too that it puts out, being able to get up to 90 miles per hour. That is at the higher end, like I said, of a non-traditional motorcycle. When you look at the others, a lot more money is going into the scooter side of things than the motorcycle. So. Mm-hmm.
No, I saw it as like a high-end hydrogen crotch rocket, you know, and I see that the appeal being more of like a good transition from like the clean cut Segway bros and shirts that are like one size too small that, you know, are aging out of the Segway and into the, you know,
a there's personal, a visual.
Yeah. It's a strong one.
Aging out of the Segway.
But I mean, so when I read the story, I don't necessarily see a product that I can use or find interesting, but I do see ongoing demand for energy efficient single passenger transportation that could sometimes have a second person on there.
The only thing that this does raise a little bit of a flag would be from a safety perspective. I mean, we are talking about pressurized hydrogen. There's mm-hmm. definitely some concerns there.
Yeah.
Especially if you're going 90 miles an hour and you lay it down. I mean, that could be a problem. Obviously, same issue with gas,
okay, yeah.
and whatever else, but yeah.
No, it was, I think you're right though, because when you think of some of the other stories that we've done on startup bikes and scooters, other than like really powerful targeted marketing campaigns, they really don't have a leg up on the competition. Where, I mean, maybe even the brand recognition power of when you see an ad that says Segway motorcycle, you're just like, I mean, just the interest in I thought that died makes it click on it. Maybe.
I would agree. Yeah. I think it's the same. I felt differently, obviously, about the Hummer when we talked about that last week.
But, yeah.
but I
yeah.
think there is something to this where you go, okay, I know that from someplace.
Right? How can you say, why can't you just let Hummer die? But Segway. No.
They are not comparable.
Hashtag save Segway, Jeff's campaign for next week.
That's right. Of all the things we do in life, we're going to bring this brand back. The third most popular story on the sites this week, the Ever Given has been impounded. The Ever Given that blocked the Suez Canal last month has been impounded. Egyptian authorities won't allow the vessel to leave the country until its Japanese owner pays at least $900 million. The money will help pay for the salvage operation, costs of stalled canal traffic, and lost transit fees for the week that the canal was blocked. Local authorities say they want to pay nothing. The company, anyways. The authorities obviously don't want to pay anything either. The ship has some $3.5 billion worth of cargo. Negotiations are ongoing. And I mean, we said it last week. Someone is going to have to pay for this. Jeff, who's it going to be?
I kind of, you know, within the context of the article, you basically, and I think they actually called it out as a quote, the Egyptian authorities were saying, you don't want this to go to court. You want to take mm-hmm. care of this right now. And I would tend to agree with them. I understand that the owners of the Ever Given are kind of trying to stand their ground and think somebody else is going to blink first. But if this would go to court, not only are they going to be dealing with the folks in the canal and all of those local authorities there, who knows who else may jump on this. If mm-hmm. they had cargo on that ship, if they had cargo that was blocked because this ship was stuck in the canal, I mean, who knows where that could end up going. So even though it's a huge amount, and hopefully maybe they're just trying to negotiate that down before they finally pay, mm-hmm. I think they need to because this could get really bad for them. They need this to go away. I mean, so even though it's a high amount, when you look at all of the things that could just continue to mount and build up and work against them, I think it behooves them to figure out a settlement here quick.
Well, part of the litigation problem was that, so it's owned by a Japanese firm, operated by a Taiwanese shipper, and flagged in Panama.
Yeah.
So, Anna, this is the story that just keeps on giving.
It does, yeah. And it's, I don't know, there's a lot from both sides that doesn't really like line up necessarily. Like, mm-hmm. There's sort of two different stories are being told. You know, Egypt is saying the ship owners don't want to pay anything. They're saying that that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
But what I didn't initially realize, actually, is that when they impounded the ship, it sounds like they essentially stranded the crew there as well, which adds some pressure, I think, to keep these talks moving, right?
Right.
I read an article in CNN that quotes Ian Beveridge, who is the chief executive of BSM, and that's the ship's technical managers. And he said that the SCA's decision to arrest the vessel is extremely disappointing. And from the outset, BSM and the crew on board have cooperated fully with all authorities, including the SCA and their respective investigations into the grounding. BSM's primary goal is a swift resolution to this matter that will allow the vessel and crew to depart the Suez Canal. So that's not actually making, you know, the SCA look good there, I don't think. But I read in another report in Times of India that they have, you know, that cited like concerns for the 25 member crew because they're based in India, and saying that they're not allowed to leave the ship. So they're also taking issue with the claims where they say that like a big chunk of this money, $300 million, is being claimed as, quote, for, quote, loss of reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And they also say that the ship's owners, via their insurers and attorneys, are negotiating in good faith, and that they made a generous offer on Tuesday that was rejected. So it's hard to know who to believe here, but I think the important point is that there are people involved mm-hmm. that are stuck there. Like, we got to figure this out.
I mean, at what point does being stranded transition to being held hostage?
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. I don't know the context. Like, are they being held on the ship, or are they like, you know, are they just, they won't let them, are they detained? I don't know.
Right. They finally free the ship. Everyone's like, all right, a little late, but let's get going. You're not going anywhere. Come on.
Yeah, I know. It's strange.
No, it's fascinating. I was kind of like, every time we see how much was actually in cargo, the $3.5 billion that was on board, that is just incredible. So at first you see the $900 million and you're like, all right, yeah, that's a little high. But I mean, it's less than a third of what they have just at stake currently out there.
Well, and there was some damage done to the canal. There is some mm-hmm. infrastructure damage that needs to be repaired. So that needs to be taken care of just to ensure future operability.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm still kind of baffled. I mean, it does have all of those different barriers in terms of where they're based out of, where they're flagged and all that. But this is a dollar amount that you just seem to want to pay to make it go away.
Yeah. Yeah. The second most popular story on the site this week was about Boeing suing subcontractors over Air Force One work. Boeing is suing Air Force One subcontractor GDC because the company allegedly ran into financial problems and missed deadlines. The problems with GDC caused millions in damages and jeopardized critical work on the aircraft. The Air Force gave Boeing $3.9 billion to convert two Boeing 747-8 planes and deliver them by December 2024. Boeing is reworking electrical power upgrades, communication systems, executive interiors, and other work on the planes at the Boeing facility in San Antonio, Texas. Jeff, was this in the documentary?
The San Antonio facility was. The insolvency of the subcontractor was not.
Okay.
And that's the one thing that raised flags for me. So they got the contract, I believe it was in the spring of 2018.
Mm-hmm.
They knew by last December that this company basically was insolvent and could not afford to pay their bills. They couldn't pay back their loans. So what took so long? Mm-hmm. Like, they knew this then, and something tells me there were some other indicators leading up to it. I don't think there was a day in December they're like, oh, hey, guess what we found out? This, you know, multi-million dollar subcontractor is a year behind and unable to perform these services because they can't keep the lights on, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit, I mean, don't want to let the subcontractor off the hook here, the subcontractor GDC Technic, but Boeing maybe rushed it a little bit in terms of picking their subcontractor. Maybe they could, something tells me in those 2.5 years, things didn't just turn on a dime and this company started going downhill. Mm-hmm. If they were really this unreliable and had this lack of financial stability, something Boeing probably should have known about beforehand and been able to react to a little more quickly. Now, Boeing's had their hands full in the last 2.5 years with some other things, too.
Right.
So mm-hmm. I think I don't want to blame them for somebody else not doing the work, But for this to come to fruition and Boeing coming across, so like, man, we trusted these guys and they totally screwed us. We had no idea. Well, they had to know beforehand things were not progressing in the right way. So it's I think it's a little bit of a dramatic act by Boeing just to put more momentum behind this lawsuit and regain whatever they can, but also being able to cancel the contract and move forward with somebody else.
Right. Anna, what do you think? Is it a result of Boeing not really doing its due diligence?
Well, I kind of think that, you know, I agree with a lot that Jeff said, mm-hmm. but I think Boeing is taking this as an opportunity to try to flip the script and make itself kind of look good, maybe.
Be the good guy?
Yeah. Well, yeah, point. I mean, like, they're fighting back at a time when they've experienced, like, even more problems with the 737 MAX right now that are now, you know, it's now being grounded again for potential electrical problems, and these are the new ones. Mm-hmm. So, like, the bad press on Air Force One is not exactly helpful right now, though at least Boeing can say, like, hey, this isn't our fault. We're dealing with it, even if it means doing this work ourselves that we had contracted out. Right. So maybe this is Boeing's chance to, like, save the day and turn some potentially bad press into something else by trying to get ahead of it.
Yeah.
They haven't made any changes to their delivery timelines at this point that I've seen. And they say, or it sounds like they're saying, that the new Air Force Ones will be on time. So I don't know. Yeah. I agree with what you're saying, Jeff, that, like, you know, maybe there wasn't, all the T's weren't crossed here. Or maybe it was a slow response, but now they have the chance to kind of change the narrative and say, we're on top of it. We're going to fix it. It's not going to screw anything up. Boeing saves the day. I don't know.
It really made me think about the risk that you run when you're looking for a partner in anything. You know, these bad deals hurt good companies all the time. I mean, bad deals hurt bad companies all the time, too. But I mean, I can't even imagine the amount of subcontractors that Boeing is working with. But it's just, you really need to make sure it's the right fit. I mean, I think that's why we see a lot of work that we get from referrals, word of mouth. You know, when we're talking about some of these smaller companies that work with these larger manufacturers, it's because, you know, they have a history of work behind them. They've been recommended. And, you know, they either worked with a partner or they worked with that company for a long time because of that. I mean, it's just, I mean, we've been with companies before where you make a bad deal with a bad partner and it nobody wins.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know. It's frustrating, but,
I think there is going to be a story that comes out with this supplier, GDC Technic, because they've been doing this for a while. I mean, this is not a small company. Mm-hmm. You just kind of wonder what happened along the way. If there were some bad decisions, if some contracts, you know, they overextended themselves on some things and just couldn't recover from it or what, because at Boeing, again, you'd think they would do their due diligence. I think there was probably a logistical appeal in the fact that they needed to have a facility large enough to handle these two huge planes. This company is located just outside of Dallas, so it was close enough to them to help. So there's probably a lot more to it, but I think Anna probably has a good point. You know, they are stepping in and saying they can save the timeline and still get everything done on time. And we've seen some positive other things from Boeing in terms of picking up. I think they got almost 200 new orders earlier this week from folks like Southwest. So maybe they're also seeing an infusion of cash that they can now commit to making sure they still hit this timeline.
Yeah. They could use some good news.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The top story this week, the electric Mustang plagued by battery trouble. Ford's first foray into long range, fully electric vehicles is the Mustang Mach-E, an SUV based on its iconic sports car. The Mach-E, which starts at more than $40,000, boasts a range of 300 miles per charge, but in order to get those miles, the vehicle, like others, electric or not, needs a 12-volt lead-acid battery to get up and running. And a software issue in some vehicles is keeping the 12-volt from charging, essentially rendering the car useless. The car has received rave reviews, but the effort has not been without its challenges. Anna, just seems like a real bummer for the electric Mustang.
It is. And, you know, we have been talking a lot globally lately about vaccine hesitancy and how we can encourage those around us to trust the medical research and technology that's behind those vaccines. And I think this is actually a good time to talk about EV hesitancy. Because, so currently electrics comprise just 2% of U.S. new vehicle sales. An AP report in March of this year cited a few recent polls on the topic, one of which suggested that only 4% of adults with a driver's license believe they will buy an electric the next time they purchase a vehicle. an additional 27% said they'd consider one. So that's less than a third of American drivers that would even consider it at mm-hmm. this stage of the game. And when you see stories like this, where vehicles are literally being bricked by a glitch, which actually applies to the software system, not the battery itself, but it makes you wonder if these reports do damage to the overall acceptance of EVs and contribute to that hesitancy. To me, it's not unlike how much coverage there is when an electric starts on fire and people get spooked, but you don't always see an equal amount of coverage of gasoline-powered vehicles starting on fire, which we know they do regularly, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
But since the technology is new, I think people are looking for a reason to distrust it or they need to vet it, right? So I don't know. I think it's arguable that a standard problem that an automaker would need to address and maybe recall carries more negative stigma when it's an EV. And I guess it's an argument towards not like rushing these out the door.
I only have to agree with you because that was my immediate reaction when I read this, is that I once again went back to like, man, I'm glad I got the hybrid, not the EV. I know it's terrible and selfish, but it's like I am part of that EV hesitancy.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not an insignificant amount that you're investing a vehicle next to your home. It's the biggest price tag, that biggest bill you have to pay. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's fair. I think what's kind of interesting here, too, is we're looking at a Mustang. First of all, how do you guys feel about the look of this Mustang? What do you think?
I feel like it's a little bit sacrilege. You know, like what a Mustang should be. Just that car. I don't think it should be.
It's kind of a bold design move.
Yeah.
I was not a big fan of it, not because it looks bad, but because of the Mustang moniker.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I'm going with this. It's a risk when you take something like a Mustang, which is such an iconic brand in itself, you make it an EV. Now, they've had about 5,000 of these vehicles delivered. You're looking at maybe 24 that have this issue. So it is a low percentage. But again, it's sort of the Tesla element of, when you're always in front of somebody saying how great it is, and then you do have a couple of glitches and people are already just looking to sort of knock you down a little bit, the impact, I think, is greater. So if this wasn't a Mustang, I wonder if the response or the reaction would be as strong.
Like if this was a Volt?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, no, it would just be like the cost of doing business, probably.
Potentially. Mm-hmm. You never know. I mean, it's still, again, a huge investment when you're looking at these vehicles. I think they retail for 40,000.
This is 40,000, yeah.
So, I mean, that's not an inexpensive car. And you want it to start, you know? I mean, you want to be able to use it, obviously. So it's not a small thing. And it does still seem, if it was anything other than the battery, you're looking at a battery for an electric car that's the problem here.
Yeah.
Now, as Anna said, it's actually the software not connecting correctly and keeping things charged. But that's still what people look at. And then they see it's a Mustang and it's just higher profile. And I think that's what's really unfortunate in terms of maybe exponentially kind of blowing up the impact here.
I agree.
So my initial reaction to this was, you know, is this an accepted risk from early adopt, you know, by early adopters of technology? You know, like, are you understanding the inherent risk with having a new technology? But then I thought, is EV technology still new? I mean, do you still, I mean, I still consider it new, even though it's been out for like more than a decade. And but it still has so little market share. Maybe that's why I still think it's their early adopters, because there's just a few of them.
It's a and the technology is changing so rapidly. So I don't think that it's fair to like compare it to the internal combustion engine that, you know, I don't know. I think it's still new.
Okay.
I think it's also application dependent. If you bought this because you thought it'd be cool to have, or if this is your everyday vehicle and your mode of transportation, because if that's the case, then that early adopter thing, that doesn't apply. You just, you bought a vehicle that was going to be what you wanted to use every day.
Well, so and are the early adopters, you know, the Volt drivers and not the EV Mustang drivers? You know?
That's true. Yeah. No, and I mean, I just think if I pay 40 grand for a new car and it just doesn't turn on, I just, frustration.
Well, can you imagine being the guy in the neighborhood being like, hey, look at my new electric Mustang.
Yeah. And you know
what? Let me fire it up for you.
Yeah. The guy who buys the electric Mustang, the first one in the neighborhood, is that guy like, yo, you see it? Yeah. It's parked right next to my electric Hummer. All right. Moving on to our next segment. In case you missed it, my In Case You Missed It this week was about researchers determining the age people are usually the happiest. And I just thought, what a good time to figure that out.
Hopefully it hasn't passed.
Well, Anna, researchers determined the age people are usually the happiest, and the answer might surprise you. You guys want to guess?
I was going to say like nine.
Nine? Okay. Anna?
I can't participate. Nine. I already read it, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah. 36. So yes, we have passed it, Anna. The sun is set on our happiness.
Is it 36? I thought they said late 30s, early 40s.
Oh, no, it was 36, but the research at Emmanuel College kind of wrapped around people in their 30s and 40s because they thought they would be the saddest because of what they call the career and care crunch, which mm-hmm. is where it's a collision of like workplace demands and demands for caring for others,
right.
You know, like your kids, your partners, and even
you don't have
parents.
To explain this to me.
I do. I'm explaining it to the people that may not be exactly in this career crunch.
But I understand what you're saying.
So, but while people in this age range admit to feeling overwhelmed, you know, having, you know, too much to do and too little time, they also talk about this specific time period being profoundly satisfying. And, you know, a lot of the stress is also what's bringing them joy. So even though it has passed me by, or I have passed it by, I have to agree that I do feel like we're in the career and crunch mode still, but it is satisfying because it's kind of past that, well, the 20s, and they were raging. And I just was kind of curious what you guys thought. I mean, Jeff, to your point, I kind of thought the same thing too, where there's like a delightful innocence with young age. Yeah. Maybe that you'd be the happiest, but then there's that like sort of like overwhelming dread where it's like, so just nothing better after that, huh? I'll tell Des he's got six more years.
No. Yeah, I mean, this was a decade ago for me, so I've got a different perspective, but I get it because, I mean, at that point, and we've talked about it, your kids are still young, mine are teenagers, so that sort of, those golden years, those great times are like, you know, 6 to 11, you know, because mm-hmm. they can do a bunch of stuff and they actually sort of listen to you a little bit and things like that. So, I mean, that would have been about that time frame for me. So, yeah, I definitely get it. Still figuring this stuff out a little bit. And,
yeah.
I mean, I ain't going to lie, though. I can't wait till they get out of the house. So I'll be hitting a happy spot here again too in a little bit.
Right. So. I mean, I think you're still in the range. You're still in the range. Like,
I'm pretty immature, so maybe that helps.
People talked about, you know, being in the prime of their lives and feeling at their peak, you know, because after years of working to develop their careers and relationship, they feel like 36 is when they finally arrive at some sort of understanding. And that just hit home to me because 36 was that like one moment where I was like, you know what? I'm not afraid to drive by a cop anymore. Like, so that's something. Anna, what's your story this week?
Yeah, so I chose the article Hand Sanitizer Goes from Short Supply to Surplus because I thought it was pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. In a recent video, we reported that U.S. sales of hand sanitizer, which soared more than 620% in 2020 to a total of $1.45 billion, have plummeted. And now suppliers are trying to figure out how to unload their overstock. So once this product was in short supply and now it's being donated by retailers to community groups and even being given away for free if you get a vaccine. So I don't know. I kind of thought this was predictable, as there's more and more established consensus about the very low transmission risk from surface contact. People are chilling out a little bit on their relentless disinfecting. I stopped disinfecting my groceries ages ago, guys.
Yeah, I never made it that far.
Yeah, though I do think that lulls and things like Clorox sprays and wipes maybe will lag. Mm-hmm. And the reason seems to be that so much surface disinfecting is still going on because businesses need to show their customers that they are taking precautionary measures. That's just my opinion, but I just predict that those types of activities are going to remain sort of front and center for a while yet because they make people feel better.
Yeah, no,
like they're being protected. Yeah. So
I agree with you. Like I made it actually into a restaurant recently, and it was almost very ceremonial how they brought the Clorox wipes out mm-hmm. in front of me, pulled them out, used them to wipe the tables off, threw them away right in front of me. You know, it seemed like they really went out of the way. Maybe it was because I was the only one in there, but to just show what they were doing with disposable products to keep everything clean. Also, I thought there was a tremendous lag in the story because two, 3 months ago is when the switch happened from finding no hand sanitizer to like gallons of it for a dollar is on a pallet when you walk into the grocery store. And also, I mean, I do. I like how the industry rallied together. You know, distillers were creating hand sanitizer. And even though it was gross and reeked of tequila, you know, it's still... You still knew
it worked.
Yeah,
gin
it worked.
Sanitizer.
Right? Yeah, just let me slather myself in this tequila scent before I drive home. Just
well, you're not afraid to drive past the cop now, so it's fine.
I'm not anymore. I'm just still. It brought the edge up a little bit.
There you go.
Just no. I found the this story interesting too, but like you said, very predictable.
Yeah, I mean, one good thing is that it indicates to me that pretty soon we can stop washing our hands again. Finally, right? Just kidding.
As part of the pandemic, I found out one thing. You can wash your hands so much to a detrimental effect where they will rock those cuticles right out.
Yeah. Mine were so awful last spring. And I was like, do you think this is good like during infectious disease season that my hands are like literally open and cracking? Like,
yeah, let's create new pits for the infection.
Just
to dive
put
into.
The virus right in there.
Mm-hmm. No, it's... It also made me really aware of how many strategically placed gallons of sanitizer we have around the office.
They last forever, though. Like, we bought a jug when our twins were born, you know, for guests to come over, you know, like, and it's one of those big gallon jugs, and we still have it. Like, I don't, maybe people overestimated how much they needed.
See, I'm on the other side of that. And it's not like a rational fear. It's just an irrational security. Like, I overuse hand sanitizer without a doubt. Like every time I come out someplace, it's way too much. And it like gets on my pants. It's like, oh, geez.
Oh, you know? Like pump it multiple
times? Yeah, it's stupid.
One pump, Jeff. One pump.
No, that's, I mean, that's.
I'm trying to help out the surplus.
Right. Well, you get those other, because you're used to the premium brands that sort of evaporate quickly, but then you get the ones that are kind of linger for a bit. And then you're working your way up the shoulder. And you're like, okay, there's nothing left
the
to
foam,
sanitize.
Man, that stuff is like.
Oh, yeah. No, it's, I mean, I do think it's. I went into the dentist the other day and I accidentally walked past the hand sanitizer without using it. Got scolded, but it made me think like, okay, we're getting into a better place where I don't like do a beeline to that to cover myself before I enter a new place business. Jeff, what was your story this week?
Well, I'll be the one bringing the dark cloud over the, the podcast here. Mine was on a story, centered down in Mexico. Now, Mexico has a long history of people tapping into like their oil pipelines and siphoning oil off of these lines. That it's owned by the government-owned oil company, Pemex, I believe is the name. But this was different. This was actually people siphoning off from a gasoline pipeline.
Ooh.
So these were folks who had dug a tunnel, okay, numerous of them. Actually, I think it was like eight of them, I think the story mentioned, dug tunnels, basically put rubber hose onto this huge gas pipeline to siphon off for their own individual use. And the problem was some of these had become loose. Mm-hmm. And so there were gas fumes in this tunnel, which that's not a good thing.
How did it not explode?
So basically they found it in time before. But what they were worried about is if they would have come across this during a time when there was flooding in the area, which would have then pushed those, done some bad things with those fumes, it could have been this huge catastrophic explosion in Mexico City, which is a hugely densely populated area. So if they would not have found it because they were making sure everything was cool in case they got all this rain and it floods, which it does during this time of year, could have been catastrophic. But they found it, patched it, filled in the tunnels, things like that. But a pretty crazy, like, there's no like safety lesson here. It's just don't steal gas, you know?
I mean, my initial thought is like, I understand if the gas barons out there are not, or pirates are not going to use the appropriate seals when they steal the gas. But also, if they're savvy enough to dig a tunnel to it, you know, they would think like, hey, wait, we need an O-ring?
Yeah, it was pretty, you know, amazing engineering getting to it. It was just, from there, it was basically, you know, a garden hose blocked up by some rocks and cardboard. And
That is
not just...
I mean, luckily they caught it in time. Like
they did. They found it, and kudos to that because,
it's not a total bummer.
That could have been one of those stories we're talking about for a while.
Yeah. So you didn't bring it all the way down. Silver lining.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Moving on to our final segment. Final thoughts this week. Anna, do you have anything for the listeners at home or work, actually, most likely?
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say was I am disappointed that I always miss. So we have a like a office hawk that like lives outside of our building.
Ooh, yeah.
Or in the area. I don't know. But it always comes over here and like eats a bird in front of everyone. And I every time I miss it eating a bird. So it did so today and I missed it again.
Having been here for the carnage, may I just say that as I'm sitting at my desk in the and flesh is raining down in front of my window.
Feathers. And
yeah, feathers. And like at first it's a couple feathers and you're like, oh, I believe a bird must have hit a window above us or something. And then the pieces start to come down.
Oh, gross.
Yeah. No, there's you're not missing
not
anything.
Not missing. Okay. I actually like birds.
Yeah.
So maybe I don't want to see this.
No. The recently named Eli Moskowitz is a hellacious beast that, and it's starting to get closer. It used to perch at the top of the building. And so, like, you know, everything kind of, the meat hit the ground with a bit more force.
He's doing what hawks do, man.
I know, but now he's getting closer. He's getting more bold.
He wants to show off for you.
Yeah, and he does.
David, you have to show him who the apex predator is.
It's him! It is him! Like, it's not
just,
me.
No, maybe go out there with some fried chicken, just, you know, in the bucket, look at him. And
whatever he ate the last time just left a talon.
You're going to bring KFC out there when the hawk's out there, Jeff? Don't do that.
Got to stand your ground. I'm not saying I would. David should.
Yeah, I'll bring a broiler chicken out there. You know, just some roasted chicken. And just,
show him who's in charge.
I'll rifle popcorn chicken at him. And he'll catch it and spit it back at me. No. It is a tenacious but yet majestic beast. I hope you catch it sometime. We have plenty of footage.
I don't know. I take it back. I don't want to see it now.
It is just... you know, really raw nature happening in front of you. Jeff, your final thought this week?
Actually, I was thinking that first story we did on the rubber shortage made me think of a book I actually read lately. If you're ever looking for a sort of condensed history of the rubber industry, I would also recommend the book just because it was really interesting. But The River of Doubt, which is basically about Teddy Roosevelt and his trip down this river in the Amazon. Mm-hmm. And he came across a lot of these settlements that were early on, like people went down there to harvest rubber.
Mm-hmm.
Make money that way because that was the only place they could find it was in the Amazon. And they smuggled out some seeds and for rubber trees and all that. Good book. Very scary. In terms of I will never have any interest. Anna doesn't want to go in space. I don't want to go anywhere near the South American rainforest. but yeah.
No, I'm always down for a good historical read.
It's a good book. I'd highly recommend it.
Very good. My final thought is actually off of yours last week where you were saying you're just so happy to be playing softball again. And then what happens? Canceled.
Yeah.
Canceled.
Snow flurries in April. That's what happens here.
Right.
What?
I think, you know, to say that under 40 degrees is too cold to play softball.
Oh.
I disagree. You know, you work up a lather and you just keep moving.
That ball comes off the bat a little different for me, man.
I mean, you just make sure that, you know, you don't hit the end of the ball at the end of the bat. You just really keep a grip on it and you just keep moving. Yeah.
There you go.
We're getting to the part of the year where I'm just going Wednesday to Wednesday until Tuesday softball starts. Then I'm going Tuesday, Wednesday to Tuesday, Wednesday. Finally, please make sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast and email the podcast. Make sure to reach any one of us, Jeff, Anna, or David at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. And also make sure to subscribe to our newsletters. We really appreciate the support. For Jeff and Anna, I'm David Manti, and this is the Today in Manufacturing podcast. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Today in Manufacturing podcast.